we're gonna chat for a while. Come listen, don't be shy. A question or two, maybe a new point of view. Don't bother asking why.
Love that. Yeah, it starts my day off right.
I wish people at home could see you doing the air drums along with it.
I can't help it, especially that. I love it. I actually think I just did the wrong. That's not what it's in it. It's whatever.
We're not going to judge you.
We're not going to judge. I'm back from Europe, everyone. Thanks for joining me and waiting a week or two for new episodes. It's actually not my fault. I had somebody scheduled for, well, it's kind of my fault. I had somebody scheduled for an episode that would have posted while I was still gone. And then he and I screwed up the time and made a poor man who's running the soundboard come in crazy early for no reason because we thought it was at night. So, sorry. Yeah. Sorry, Ryan. Anyway, I'm sitting here with today's guest, which will air tomorrow. So, hello, future people.
Hello.
I hope the war that starts today, I don't know where I'm going with this.
Not today.
Well, it starts Wednesday. We're probably going to be in war soon. There's tons of anarchy crap happening in Texas
right now. Okay. I got my earthquake kit.
You did?
Yeah. I mean,
my earthquake kit is my friend John. I go to his place because he has a bunch of guns and supplies.
We have a friend in the mountains of Acton, and so she's kind of our last ditch. Like if things get really bad,
what's your earthquake kit though?
It's like a bunch of water, like the water barrel,
nice,
and then a lot of food. We don't have enough weapons, but I'm trying to be a living weapon.
Nice.
So hopefully that.
Yeah, that's right. What belt are you?
I'm an advanced green in Kempo, 6 years in, working on my brown belt, which, you know, when you test for your brown belt, they like literally paper up the windows of the dojo. Nobody knows what happens. It's secret. It's called the trial.
Really?
Yeah. And if anybody at home could see me, I'm 5'6". I'm a little pudgy around the middle, but you know.
But that's, I was talking about this recently with a friend of mine. Most of my friends who are like 8th degree black belts.
Yeah.
You like America Young. Mm-hmm. There's like a black belt stunt woman. You would never expect it looking at her. Yeah. John, the Nia stuntman, he just looks like a drinking bro, and he's like a ninja.
Yeah.
Like most of the people I know who could kick your ass and kill you, you would never expect.
Most real fighters, most people that are like deadly weapons, they're just, you know, they're normal people. They just know how to fight.
Yeah. Nowadays, though, we see like Ronda Rousey and The Rock, and you expect to be able to like, oh, that person has giant biceps, you could kill me, which they probably could.
They could, yeah. But they're also, they know how to fight, and they have the like massive body armor.
It's like the mountain versus the scorpion. You know,
exactly. Yeah, which, America, she actually trained at my dojo for a little while.
Oh, that's
how we met. We had a David Blue moment on the mat. I'm like, hey, we know David.
Is that what people are calling it, a David Blue moment?
They are now. They are now.
We haven't even said who you are yet, but the coincidences of this world are freaking me out these days.
Mm-hmm.
Freaking me out. I've had a few in the past week that have terrified me. Like people who, well, the best example is I was in Rome and I turned a corner and I bumped into someone that I knew. I'm like, what are you doing in Rome? Same thing with New York. I was walking through Times Square and I bumped into Mike Dressel.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A guy from our days. We both are from a similar area.
We are.
You and I. Yeah. So I am talking with those of you who, now that I know that not everyone clicks, the names. Some of you don't know who you're listening to, subscribers. The Renaissance Man of Orlando.
Oh, gosh.
Told you I Google stalked
you. You did Google stalk me.
Mr. Babica DeRosa. Hello, Bob. Introduce yourself to people who don't know who you are.
I'm Bob DeRosa, and I am a screenwriter from Orlando, Florida, now living in Los Angeles.
Orlando, Florida, being where I went to college and lived a little bit after college. But you didn't go to UCF.
No.
University of Central Florida.
UF,
right? You're a Gator.
Yeah, I'm a Gator. I went to University of Florida. It was one of those things where I had like a really tight group of friends from high school, and we were all kind of like nerds. And we all, everybody kind of just ended up going to UF together. I don't know how we all chose it together.
High school?
Lake Mary High School.
Oh, yeah. Everybody from UCF was from Lake Mary.
Were they? Yeah. And so, yeah, it was like I had a couple of friends that went up to FSU. Oh, nobody went to UCF. I don't know anybody from my class.
That's still true now. No, actually UCF is weirdly grown to have a bigger enrollment than UF and FSU combined.
Really?
I heard this recently, yeah. Which is unfortunate because no one still knows the school because yeah. our football team only recently got good.
Yeah. But it's like weird because like now, as far as like an art school, it's like theater program and film program, they're like totally off the like charts. It's
oh,
incredible,
yeah.
Which they weren't like known for that when I was, if they were known for that when I was there, I'd have been like, hey, maybe I should just go there. But like we went to UF and for me, I was like, I was already a creative person and you know, UF wasn't exactly the perfect place to go, but we kind of made it that way.
You know, it's weird. I don't want to claim credit in any way by us, but a very, very similar experience for me. I was, my brother went to FSU, so I was considering FSU, mm-hmm. but then I got a scholarship and pre-accepted to UF. So I actually got an apartment at the courtyard at UF.
Oh yeah, yeah. Oh, it's a place like they had like the furnishings and like yeah, silverware and everything.
Because I didn't have anything.
Yeah.
I remember I was going to be a computer science major, but I really, really had loved acting, and I kind of mm-hmm. just hit me out of nowhere. I'm like, what if I can make a living doing this? And I visited UCF because they had also accepted me, and I walked into the theater and mm-hmm. I loved it. I'm like, oh, this place, these people are like building it on their own.
Yeah.
And I loved their productions, and so I just changed my mind last minute, and I always felt that way. We kind of felt like we were building the program
right.
ourselves.
Yeah.
And we kind of, everyone did, like us, the seniors, like the Manny Mosses, like everybody mm-hmm. built right. that program up, and Dr. C built it up, and then right. Dr. C retired and it all went to crap. And I understand now they're rebuilding it back up, like with new chairs, but they right. apparently they hired a chair to replace Dr. C that, hi everyone from UCF, we're talking about you. But that's a great feeling to feel like you're building the program. It sucks because you kind of graduate without the claim attached to your degree.
Yeah, it's weird because like I grew up writing. I knew I was going to be a writer. I didn't know I was going to be a filmmaker and a screenwriter until I was in college. Mm-hmm. So if I'd have known that, like I just started dipping my toe in that in high school. If I'd have known that's what I wanted to do, I may have chosen, say, FSU, which actually had a film mm-hmm. department. You know, like UF didn't have a film department.
Really?
They had like a film studies thing. Hmm. You know, I ended up taking a lot of like film studies classes, which then became my English minor, I guess.
But what was your degree?
Advertising.
What?
Because my mother wanted me to have a career that I could fall back on. I'm going to put that in air quotes because I think
that's
the fallback career.
Do.
They do. But it was like the one sort of business degree that I could like wrap my head around and go, well, there's at least a little something creative there. Mm-hmm. But then, of course, all I did was take all creative writing classes and film studies programs. And they had a little club called the Crosscut Film and Video Society where you could check out.
So nerdy.
It was so nerdy. You could check out a super VHS camera and they had a little tape to tape, you know, wow. editing system in like a room, like a third of what we're sitting in, just a little closet. But, so in other words, they didn't really have a film program, but if you took enough classes and met enough people and like, you know, one of my best friends growing up, Ken Davis and I were both there together and we just started making movies on nice. Our own. And so we kind of created our own film education, even though there wasn't one actually there. Mm-hmm. And that's when I was like 1 year in and we made our first short film and showed it to an audience of 30 people and they all laughed at the right spots and went, oh, this is the rest of my life. And it was like very clear to me then.
You said you'd always wanted to be a writer
yeah.
before. Let's touch on the end of the story first. So you are a writer.
Yeah.
A screenwriter.
Yeah.
One might say. Although you do write stuff for theater still.
Sacred, oh, yeah.
Sacred Fools. Totally. Like you have a play on right now.
We just wrapped up a season. I'm a member of Sacred Fools Theater Company in Hollywood, and they do this late night show called Serial Killers, which every week the audience sees five ongoing serials and kills two.
Nice.
And then two new pilots come in the next week to try to knock off the champions. And they at the end of the season, they take all the top shows of the season and they have a giant playoff. Like start with 16 shows, whittle it down to two finals, and the audience chooses a winner. And I've always made it to like top six. And I just wrote a show called All the Best Killers Are Librarians, and we won the championship.
Congratulations.
So we are champions of season 10, so 10 years in. And this was on Saturday night. So
you know what that reminds me of that I kind of wish I don't see people do? And I actually have kind of always kept on to it, held on to it, going like, maybe one day I'll do it. Remember Caffeine?
Oh, yeah.
The theater, like it was a weekly, but it was like a sitcom on stage.
Yeah.
That was a new episode every little while. Manny Moss was in it.
Yeah.
Todd Kimbrough.
He wrote and produced. That was their theater company. I think it was Caffeine Productions or something. But they got their own space and they would do that. It was like an ongoing comedy soap opera sort of.
Yeah, it was like a soapy Friends.
Yeah. But like my improv troupe, them, we would do late night shows there after mm-hmm. that show.
So which is weird to me that you and I didn't really ever meet back then.
I was thinking about it today. Like, had we ever met in Orlando?
I don't think so. No. Although I don't really remember when we first met. But end of the story first.
I do.
You do?
We can get to it later.
We can get to it later. Because I know this podcast is all about me and my experiences. Mm-hmm.
And the David Blue moment.
So, Bob DeRosa, I'm going to make you do it. I haven't written here, but I'm going to make you do it.
Mm-hmm.
What have you written that, what is on your resume that catches people's attention that they're like, oh, you're the screenwriter?
Okay. So like my biggest professional success was the movie Killers, starring Ashton Kutcher and Katherine Heigl, which opened in thousands of theaters. And we can talk about the journey to get that movie made, but I'm so excited that it got made and seen all over the world and blah, blah, blah. I also wrote the indie film, The Air I Breathe, which was a $10 million indie labor of love with an amazing ensemble cast like Sarah Michelle Gellar and Kevin Bacon and Andy Garcia and Brendan Fraser and Emile Hirsch, Forrest Whitaker before his Oscar. And
nice.
I co-wrote that with the director, Ji Ho Lee. And so those are my two movie credits. I've been a professional screenwriter for over a decade. So I've written movies for studios. I've sold other things. And then just recently kind of started moving into television. And I worked on the fourth season of White Collar, which I was already a fan of. So getting, my first job in TV as a story editor on White Collar and getting to co-write an episode and being a part of that, that show's journey was an awesome experience. And so now I'm developing stuff in both TV and film world and releasing a web series and, branching out and trying to be a content creator in multiple media.
Actually, for those of you who listen to other podcasts on geeknation.com, which you should, the web series he's referring to is produced by the Adam Green of Movie Crypt. Right.
Yeah,
we actually
self-produced it, and then we were kind of looking for a home.
Or distributed by.
It's distributed.
Distributed.
Adam has his website, Aeriescope.com, and which is kind of like where all his stuff lives. And he started creating his own web series called Scary Sleepover, which is super cool. Horror icons come over, and they have a slumber party.
Do they do that here? They don't do that here, do they?
They don't. He shoots that actually in his studio.
Okay.
Adam,
I actually got really jealous when I heard about them. Like, is he having sleepovers at Geek Nation? And I didn't know. Were we allowed to do that?
So he was kind of at that moment where his series is starting to get to towards the end of his first season, and he wanted to bring in something else. And I'd actually co-created 20 Seconds to Live, which is a very short horror comedy web series. And I co-created it with Ben Rock, another UCF alum.
That's not how I know him. I think I know him because of, was it you? I needed somebody else to stay with us at Sundance, and I think you maybe recommended
that's
him.
That's probably how Alicia, that happened.
And, small freaking world. And then he ended up running the board on our play at SciFest.
Oh, SciFest, yeah. He's doing it right now for SciFest.
Tiny world, connections.
Ben's a fantastic director, and so we created this web series, and Adam was kind of at the exact moment, was like, I need some new material, but I need it to be exactly the right and fitting our brand, and kind of his horror comedy audience is exactly what we're doing with our show, so it was one of those perfect moment things. And so they're going to host it, and it launches June 5th on Aeriescope.com.
We're going to revisit that at the end of the podcast. Great. I just wrote on the table. That was terrible. Okay, so now jumping back. So you knew you wanted to be a writer.
Yes.
At that point of your life, did you know you wanted to be a writer as in like books and plays, or did you just kind of just know you wanted to write stuff?
I wrote short stories from when I was 6 years old on. And I was always the kid in school who was the writer. Everybody just knew I was that guy. And I started in high school. I tried to write a novel once and got really frustrated because it was so much description and world building. And all I wanted to do was write the action and the dialogue. and it was a moment of maybe you want to write movies. And so me and my friend Ken, who we went to high school together, we would convince our English teacher, instead of having to write a paper on whatever we were doing, to let us make a short film about that subject matter.
Really?
And so, and when I say short film, I mean crappy VHS home video camera, cutting it VCR to VCR, old school style.
That's horrible.
But we would do that in a second instead of writing a paper on something. So we did those kinds of things together. And then when we got into, college, I wrote a little, kind of a parody of Twilight Zone, and Ken and I shot it. And it was that feeling of wait.
This is what I should be doing.
I'm glad I wrote prose all those years. I might come back to it someday, but it was that moment of this is the right medium for me. This
I wonder
is where
how
I belong.
Many people's careers did not end up, how many Spielbergs were missing because people didn't have the technology when they were young. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, the youngins, those damned youngins, yeah, can so easily edit on Final Cut.
Right.
Well, maybe not Final Cut, because that's actually, you'd need to learn it. not X, but that's terrible. But maybe iMovie. You know, it's an easy cut, drag and drop kind of thing. I remember in middle school, I was in TV productions, just to show you how cool I was.
Nice.
And I remember wanting to, they were doing like school pictures, and I'd recorded a bunch of them. And I wanted to set it to the Beverly Hills Cop, or was it Fletch?
Right.
And I wanted to have it cut each time that there was like a beat in the song to a different person getting a picture taken. And I probably got 30 seconds into it via the tape to tape editing thing. And I was like, this is terrible. I was like, I'm not meant for editing and filmmaking at the time, and probably pursued acting for that. Had I been like that easy drag and drop nowadays, I might be making movies.
But here's the, I have the point of view that like, if you come up in a moment when things are a little bit hard.
Oh, definitely.
Like the technology is there, but it's just a tiny bit out of reach. Then it forces you to go, well, am I the person who's going to make the leap and make that reach and make something happen? Or am I going to person go, oh, I can't quite get there, I'm going to pull back.
Absolutely. You're right. We probably called all the lazy ones out.
That's the thing. I think it's almost like now everybody can make something, so everybody does make something. So now
it's
just
all
like,
terrible. Thanks, YouTube.
It's not like just because the technology's there, there's a million fantastic storytellers.
True.
Learning how to be a good storyteller is still incredibly difficult. So it's just a matter of who's going to stick it out and make 100 terrible things before they finally make something good. I think that's the calling out now, which is just a matter of just quantity. Can you just make enough bad stuff where you finally get good?
But that's... I think I recently decided the name of my autobiography is probably going to be Get Off My Lawn, because I've become that old, angry, bitter, everyone needs to stop. Like, I was just talking to a lawyer yesterday about this. Like, there's too much content. Like, I love that there's more content and availability. Instead of, like, 5 networks, there's 1,000.
Right.
But because of it, it's hard to find good stuff.
Yeah.
And because of the internet's just saturated in crap, and I guess I'm too old to understand good stuff because I don't get like PewDiePie and these people who like yell at video games and then get bajillion viewers. I don't understand it.
Yeah.
But the access is easier and people can be more creative and we might discover even better talent because of it eventually. And
absolutely.
Not the past couple of years, but eventually. Eventually. I just, this isn't a movie. Have you seen Pitch Perfect 2 yet?
No. I really want to.
I'm just going to really quickly say that I liked the first one. I wasn't expecting to like the first one. I really did. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
And I went in to see it yesterday, and I was so excited when I heard that Elizabeth Banks directed it.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, oh, good for her. Yes, women filmmakers. Right. Let's really prove everybody, oh, this is crap. This is terrible. Badly edited, badly shot, badly written, which isn't her fault.
Right. See, I haven't seen it, so I can't jump into the cut. Because the first one, here's the thing. You did musical theater, so there's things in that movie that you would like. Mm-hmm. For me, there's nothing about that movie that whatsoever that I should enjoy, and yet I can watch that movie any day of the week. It's perfect. That movie's amazing.
That's what drove me nuts, is like when it's on HBO, there's very few movies that I've seen before and I could see it again.
Yeah.
You know, as Dawson said in Dawson's Creek, the Roadhouses, like when it's on, you're like, I have to watch it beginning to end. Big Trouble, Little China, can't turn it off.
Yep.
Stuff like that. Yeah. Man of Steel going right off. Not watching that one again. Pitch Perfect, if it's on in the background while I'm writing or something, totally. Pitch Perfect 2, I actually had that thought during the movie, which is never a good sign if you're thinking about other crap during the movie. I was like, I never want to see this again.
Oh.
The music isn't good. The direction isn't good. There's scenes that don't belong in there. There's other scenes that are cut way too short. And that's not the writer. The writing was terrible. So that's the writer's fault.
Right.
Or whoever decided. Not. Sorry. That's someone's fault. That's not Elizabeth Banks, probably. Yeah. I'm not blaming Elizabeth Banks for plot issues.
I feel terrible. I can't defend anybody in this situation. I can't agree because I haven't seen the movie.
Fair enough.
I feel.
But you and I have been in film long enough that I feel like if you say to me it was the cinematographer's issue, I'm going to believe you that you were able to see that. So I hope you can believe me when I'm like, there are certain things that is the writer's fault. And then there are certain things that's the director, some of the editor, some of the producer.
But we could have an entire podcast on how movies that seem to feel like the screenwriter's fault are not the screenwriter's
fault. Name
one. Killers.
Oh, Jesus, that was amazing. You couldn't plot that transition. Wow. So, okay. See, I didn't want to get too deep into that because you have mentioned it to me before. But also, I feel like I've read some interviews where you've kind of touched on it. But you're also really good and very UN Switzerland about it.
Yes, I am.
However, briefly,
explain
to people at home what you mean by that.
What I mean by that is, I wrote a, say, $25 million cool little action movie about a guy who discovers he has five killers in his life and has to figure out who they are while keeping his marriage together.
Cool concept.
And it was called Five Killers. And it was like basically trying to be the best Jason Statham movie ever written. And right. Lionsgate picked it up right before the writer's strike. And they were like, we're going to make this movie. I'm like, awesome. And then through the course of development, my action movie with a rom-com subplot became a rom-com with an action movie subplot. And so when it comes out, it's no longer a story about this guy. It's a story about Katherine Heigl screaming and being hilarious and, you know, hopefully being hilarious. It became this kind of big, broad comedy with a little action movie subplot. And kind of what I wanted the movie to be was kind of jammed into a little little corner of the movie. And the thing is I was involved with the movie. I did multiple drafts for a couple of different directors. And eventually, you know, Rob Lucchetta came on to direct it, and Ashton Kutcher came on as an actor. And then just the movie kind of just became what it is, which is not exactly what I envisioned. There's a lot of what I wanted it to be still there, but a lot of it's not. And is that my fault? There was a point when I was replaced, and literally the most expensive writers in Hollywood came after me and rewrote that movie. And really talented people worked in that film. And there was, you know, there was executives and producers, and there was a lot that happened through the course of the development of that film. At the end of the day, they made the best movie they could. They put it in theaters. They crossed their fingers. People liked it. I don't think they loved it. I think some people didn't like it at all. Point is, a lot of people still come to me and says, you know what? I had a date night with my wife, and we watched your movie, and it was really funny. We had a good time.
Totally. There's what I would consider terrible stuff out there that people connect with.
Yeah.
You know, like, I do not like JAG. And it's a very, it was a very popular television show. Let's go with more recent. Everyone I know loved It Follows.
Right.
I thought it was a waste. I really feel like they wasted an opportunity there. But when I place blame, or just questioning blame, I'm not like, you ruined it because you made art. So I'm not, you know, that film critic cult thing, I'm not going to say it was, I hate it, you know, but I feel like there are certain things that you can look at and really pick apart. This industry is hard. Especially people who aren't in the industry.
Right.
Because they do tend to blame things easily, the writer, the whatever.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's ridiculous because sometimes the name of the writer on the movie isn't really necessarily the writer.
Yeah.
You know, that happened with, not to get controversial, we won't get deep into it, but like Chronicle, you know, like I know the person who originally pretty much wrote Chronicle. And then I also know Max Landis, who got a lot of acclaim for Chronicle. And
some people have entire careers built on a film they didn't actually write, or didn't write the stuff that you think you love the movie for.
And we're going to get into that. I want to actually ask those questions about, like, the logistics of it.
Right,
But at the same time, I feel like if you watch a movie and all of the lines are terrible, the plot's really messy.
Yeah.
And I think there comes a point where you can say, okay, no matter how many producers messed it up, no matter how many cinematographers messed it up, no matter how many editors messed it up, the script is not good. It's flawed. I think there's, at a certain percentage of that, you can kind of go, the writer fucked up. Am I wrong? If you wrote a script, hypothetical situation, if you wrote a script, they bought it, brought someone else on to rewrite, brought someone else on to pump it up, brought somebody else on to rewrite that, and it came out.
Yeah.
And it was just messy as hell. And it didn't even reflect your original script.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's still fair to say that there was a problem. There was a problem with the script, you know,
The original script.
Well, no, I'd have to read the original script, I guess.
Which is the problem. See, the people, when they never read the original script, they don't read all the drafts.
True.
Nobody wants to do that. The problem is film is a collaborative medium, and every moment, every day is a chance to mess it up. Mm-hmm. Every day. I mean, the fact that any movie turns out good is a miracle.
Oh, yeah.
Because
look at Age of Ultron. Spoiler alert. Did you watch it?
Yeah, totally.
Did you watch it? Okay. This isn't a huge spoiler, but don't switch off the podcast because I'm talking about it right now. But essentially, I left it and I was underwhelmed. Mm-hmm. The first one was amazing. I saw it twice in a week. This one was, I didn't hate it, but it was just kind of like meh. And I didn't even think about specifically what I didn't like until I read the interview with Joss Whedon, where he talked about how originally it was a 3-hour, 5-minute movie that they made him cut down to 2-hour, 10.
Yeah.
And the first thing they said was get rid of was the Thor plot line. And I went, that's one of the things that bothered me.
Yeah.
They kept flashing a random crap like in the pool.
Yeah.
And I'm like, this makes no sense. And all of a sudden, you know, all this stuff, what is going on? And then I read the description of what it was originally. And I'm like, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Don't know if It would have made the movie better,
yeah.
But at least it wasn't a plot hole, and these studio execs made you cut it.
Yeah.
So these people didn't know what the hell they were doing.
You could feel the weight of the process on that movie.
Yes.
Like, I need to address all these major characters. I need to deal with all these incredible movie stars. I need to bring in new characters, and I need to set up plot lines for movies that are going to come. The weight of that, and like, if there's anybody in Hollywood that can balance weight on their shoulders, it's Joss Whedon.
Yeah.
And yet the movie came out and everybody's like, eh, that's pretty good. And I feel like the weight of that development and what it needed to accomplish was just, I don't think anybody could have made that movie as awesome as the first movie.
But perfect example of get off my lawn. Pitch Perfect 2, number one movie this weekend.
Yeah.
50% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Mm-hmm.
Avengers number 2.
Right.
Like, way more higher percent on Rotten Tomatoes. Flawed movie.
Uh-huh.
Number 3, I believe.
Right.
I might be switching the two.
Yep.
Mad Max.
Yes.
So much fun.
Yeah.
Hour and a half action sequence.
Mm-hmm.
Not really much a plot or lines. Just a really fun movie to watch.
Yeah.
So in that sequence, we see that huge profit for a movie that's really flawed.
Yeah.
And closely followed by another one that's a little underwhelming, but we just like to watch it. How are we supposed to make quality anymore?
Well, I think the problem is that it goes back to what you're saying, like how the internet's just filled with stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like there's making a good movie and then there's just making a movie that people pay attention to.
And that's been the eternal debate forever.
Absolutely. And it's that debate's not going to go away and it's only going to get worse. So like you see something, you know, like I loved Mad Max. I think it's really cool.
It was great.
Yeah.
I would see it again. And it was a lot of fun, yeah. Despite the fact that we drank a lot.
Right. But it still works when like you see a movie like have you seen Ex Machina yet?
I loved it.
Yeah. That movie is amazing. And that felt like a movie that was going to come out and do a tiny bit of box office and they put it out on DVD and people would discover it later.
Mm-hmm.
And yet something weird, like what used to happen, happened, which is like people were watching it. Everybody talked about it. And then they started kind of branching it out. And now it's opening in more theaters and the word's getting out.
But it's not going to make nearly as much as any of the top three movies right now.
No.
And I always have to remind myself that we live in LA.
Yeah.
So things that we consider successes, like I never know until I call my parents in Florida. I'm like, oh my God, did you see this movie? And they're like, we've never heard of this movie. And they just usually don't until I tell them to go find it.
Right.
You know, like mm-hmm. We live in like this bubble in LA where we drive around and there's movie, the whole city is movie billboards. It's ridiculous. And you don't even realize that that's unusual until you drive through Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, oh, like food and bourbon and shit.
Yeah.
I don't know why I said bourbon because that's where it comes from. But like the whole culture here is movies and entertainment.
Yeah.
Question.
Yes.
What percentage of the on-screen killers was still your work, would you say?
That's a complicated question because I'm
going to make you boil it down to percentage.
I went to arbitration for my credit.
Ooh.
In which I had to literally prove that more than 50% of what was on screen was mine.
Okay,
And then I won that arbitration.
Okay, so fair enough.
And so, yeah.
Okay. Let's go through the nitty gritty. Mm-hmm. Oh, there are so many questions.
I know.
This is going to be a really long episode.
Isn't it?
So I'm going to gloss over this because you said it before in interviews. Yeah. So I'm going to I wanted to talk about it, but I'm going to make other people look it up. So from Orlando, you did a lot of improv. I love the fact that you said improv helped you flesh out real characters as a writer, which is
absolutely
really brilliant and smart, which is why I think sometimes I hate that people look down on actors who are also writers because it doesn't make sense. An actor is really good at finding the voice of a character. And as a writer, if you can do that for multiple characters at the same time, you write interesting characters. Yeah. I wrote a script once and a friend of mine was like, wow, this, like, I've never read a script where, like, this is how people talk.
Yeah.
Well, that's my job.
Yeah,
that's my job.
Yeah.
You've acted.
I have, yeah.
You have acted. And I actually do want to talk about you moving into writing. Nitty gritty. How does one make a living as a writer? Because I have friends who pump up scripts. I have friends who do treatments, who do pitches. What helps you make a living as a writer? Because you can't sell a movie once a year. Most people, or every few months.
Right.
So how do you piecemeal a living together?
That is the eternal question. And the problem is it's changing. It's changed even in the period of my my career. So it's always having a fresh sample of what you're good at available for people to read to remind them of what you're good at.
Oh, no. I'm not saying how do you get attention or build a career. I mean, literally financially.
Financially?
Because, you know, are you... Or let's say hypothetically, a writer.
Yeah.
a writer of your level who looks like you and does your type of work, do they need to do a treatment of a script or do a draft of a script once a month in order to pay the bills and then hopefully sell a movie every couple of years? Or how do you piecemeal a living together?
I sell a movie every couple of years and make a lot of money and then make that money last until you sell the next thing. And sometimes you work several times in a year. Sometimes you don't work at all in a year. And it's really harrowing and crazy because you just never know when the next paycheck's going to come along or if it's going to be two paychecks in a row.
So not specific amounts that you've made, but let's say a writer who's written a couple of movies has a script out there. It gets attention. What is the range that someone will pay for a script like that? Are we talking from like 10,000 to 2 million or is it a little bit smaller? It's more like 50 grand for a script.
Yeah. I mean, once you're a working writer, like you kind of make high five or low six figures when you're a new writer. You sell your first script, you're making maybe 100 grand for that script. And, my first job in Hollywood, I did a couple steps. I ended up getting like 100 grand. And in my mind, I'm like living in an apartment in Burbank with one of my best friends. I'm like, yeah, I'm rich. Yay. And the money does not last.
No, because then you live off of that forever.
You live off of that while you're doing the job and then looking for the next job.
That's the thing people don't get in this industry, which always blows my mind. They're like, you got 100 grand for that project. And you're like, yes, but then I didn't work for 10 months. Yeah. So essentially I got 10 grand a month.
Exactly. And so
that sounds like a lot, but I didn't work for 2 years, and I got like 4 grand a month.
What's happening? In the whole world, especially, all over the country, there's kind of the middle class is getting kind of taken away. So there's, there's the poor and there's the rich, and there's the exact same thing happening in Hollywood, and specifically screenwriters. You've got brand new people coming off making, new writer money, which is that, 90 or 100 grand. And then you've got the A-listers who are making the $1 million a script or $2 million a script. And the people in the middle, which is kind of where I've lived for a while, those jobs are going away. So it's like either they want to get somebody brand new. Like you'll see sometimes somebody's first credit will be, a massive movie because they're paying that person 100 grand to get them started. And then they're paying the $2 million guy to come in and rewrite it. And then they pay another, the other woman, $2 million to come in and then rewrite him. And then all of a sudden, the movie gets made. And so all those people in the middle making hundreds of thousands, aren't getting the work anymore. So it's either you have to lower your quote or you have to get that piece of writing or get a movie made that makes people go, oh my God, you're $1 million guy.
Thing as I would say the acting world right now. Yeah. The middle class is kind of going away. I mean, so much so that we were watching Game of Thrones, I think, and a trailer came on and I was aware of it, but Megan wasn't. And she's like, oh, this movie looks amazing. I went, it's not a movie, just wait. Yeah. And then she's like, True Detective season 2, are you kidding me? Vince Vaughn, Colin Farrell, Rachel McAdams, Taylor Kitsch. Like, what are we supposed to do for a living anymore? And that's, you're either the bajillion-dollar guy or you're the guy who has like 5 shorts at Sundance.
Yeah.
It's really weird. But I'm curious with the writing side of things, because people get hired up to... Is the phrase pump up a script or do a pass on a script?
Yeah.
But then they don't actually get a credit?
Yeah. Lots of script doctoring and just...
Script doctoring. That's the word I was looking for. Can you make a living as a script doctor?
I think yes, you can, absolutely, especially on the higher end. But even on the middle end, if you just become really good at a particular thing and you have enough places in town that know that you're really good at that particular thing, you can do it. I've done it before, but I don't make a living at that. I make a living at selling stuff, getting stuff made. Another thing we didn't talk about is residuals, that once you get something made, the residuals is a huge part. It's like the passive income. It's having a body of work.
Does it decrease like it does for actors?
Absolutely. My first year after Killers was like, oh my gosh. And then the second year was like, and now it's kind of like, yay.
You're like, I bought stamps. Woo.
Yeah.
I'll still get checks for like 5 cents. I'm like, wait, that's
yeah. The, writers, it's a little better than that, but it's way harder. I have way fewer credits. I've got, three.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
How do you make a living as a script doctor when you just said, people know you as that and they get hired because of that. But if people aren't seeing your name on the script to know that you doctored, how are they ever knowing that you're a good script doctor?
Well, because it's a really small town. And so the executives know each other and they know pretty quickly, oh yeah, so-and-so did some work for that movie and it got, and there's different types of script doctoring. There's the, you need to do the work that's going to get the director to sign on and then the movie starts to happen. And so people figure out who's the person who can kind of get it, down the field. And if that's your reputation, if it gets around, it's also the opposite. We're like, oh yeah, so-and-so turned in a draft and it went back into development hell. And so that can hurt your career. You know, I've had both steps. I've had like, oh my gosh, you did this stuff. Thank you. You're hot. Everyone wants to talk to you. And then I turn something in and they're like, not so great this time. And I'm like, great. It's like this whole like, we try to create this image that our career is always kind of ramping up and up, yeah, and up and up and up. And it's more of like, you know,
it's an ebb and flow for sure.
It's an ebb and flow. Absolutely. You know, and it's always the great thing about being a writer is that you can always create a new piece of material to remind people of, you know, why you're good at what you do, why you make a living at what you do.
Now, it's interesting to me because it's the way I feel about actors out here, which my friends, I'm not in the minority, but looking at the larger scheme of things, I am, where I feel like we should all be helping each other and lifting each other up and being positive. But there's a lot of annoying competition, especially in the acting world, and jealousy, and it's really frustrating. I've always been interested on your Twitter and what have you, that you are very much somebody who tries to inspire other writers. And whether it be taking part in the writing sprints and talking about the Jane Espenson things, right, or talking about books that people should read and inspiring other people. Are you in the minority in the writing world, or is it generally a pretty collaborative, like help each other out kind of world?
I feel like it feels like it's a help you out kind of world, but maybe it's just because the people that I pay attention to are the people that do that as well. So like I look up to like John August and Craig Mazin, and they're, you know, they do the Script Notes podcast, and they're 100% like, let's give back. They don't make a buck off that. They're all about let's help people be better writers. Let's help the culture of writers in this town be a healthier, more successful place. And so, you know, now you've got Children of Tendu, which is Javier and Jose's podcast. You haven't listened to it? Absolutely. Okay. It's a television writer's podcast, and they take you through every step from getting your agent to running your own show. And there's no reason for those guys to do that except to make it easier for other people to come behind them and do it. And I think anybody that's like, I'm going to keep my secrets to myself, it's like, that's such an old school thinking.
It is, but at the same time, like, I've probably mentioned it before, but like, there was a movie that I went in on that I think I got a call back, but it didn't go further. But I read the script and I called up Bria Grant and I said, there's a role in this. It's perfect for you. You need to call your people. And she called and went in. I don't know if she booked it or she almost booked it. And she called me and said, thank you. No one ever does that.
Yeah.
I'm like, why? Why? I mean, even if it's my competition, we used to call each other all the same types. We had like a little like call list and we were like, hey, dude, I just went out for this commercial. You should have been there. And people would just go in on each other's auditions. Because if my mentality is, if not me, then you. Like, I would rather my friend get it. If I'm not going to get it, I mean, I'd rather get it. But if not, I'd rather my friend get it. It seems to be a rare thing in this industry, and I don't know why.
Well, I mean, there's this kind of myth of scarcity of like, there's only so much money to go around, only so many parts to go around, only, you know. And that's sort of true, but the thing I always think about is like, you know, all the time they say, you know, a studio can only spend so much money on screenplay development every year. And they get to a point where they say, okay, Warner Brothers is done. They're not going to buy anything more this year. And then the next week they buy something because it's amazing. Mm-hmm. So to me, anytime somebody says, oh, I'm sorry, the coffers are bare, there's no more money, there's no more roles, there's no more movies that we're making, they're always going to find it if they're passionate about something. And so like, if we're all kind of working together and all kind of, you know, if we kind of just say there's not scarcity, there's plenty for everybody. If we all work together, if we're all passionate about what we do, if we all bring something exciting to the table, I think a lot of people that like want to hold on to what they get are the people that maybe are not as serious about their craft. They're more about like, gimme, gimme, gimme.
And
that energy is like, I just think it's so old school. It's to me, and I think if you're generous, the universe is generous back to you.
I'd like to believe it, but every time I've started with that belief, and then it was slowly beaten out of me. And then I went, no, I need to hold on to it. And I brought it back. And then it was beaten out of me again. Like, I feel like every time I believe that, I like to believe this podcast, I should rename it the Luck Podcast, because everybody who comes on here ends up with a series. It's really weird. Everybody who's come on lately has ended up on a show.
I have a pilot in negotiations. Maybe I'm going to have a series.
If it does, I'm renaming this damn podcast. I mean, I'm going to a screening tonight of Claudia Black's new pilot.
Right.
That when she came on, she hadn't worked for a little bit. Yeah. And now I'm like, I'd like to believe that. Right. I hope I'm not like Good Luck Chuck and I'm giving everyone else luck, but mine is terrible. And also a terrible movie. really not a good movie. But I want to ask about the holding on to things. Yeah. Was it Save the Cat where he talks about the book on screenwriting that everybody says you need to read, and it's a good book, where he talks about being open and talking about your projects with people.
Yeah, absolutely.
It was Save the Cat, right?
Yeah, yeah. Blake Snyder's Save the Cat, which I'm a huge fan of. It's gotten kind of a backlash lately. I think people are kind of pointing at it as like, this is why movies are not so good anymore. And I'm like, I don't agree with that at all. That book changed my life. But yeah, he was very much, there's a part in the book where he talks about like literally pitch your movie to strangers when you're in line at Starbucks.
Yeah.
Hey, let me pitch you my movie. And I think that takes it too far. I never pitch a movie to a stranger, but all the time when I'm working on something and my friends all the way to acquaintances go, hey, what are you working on? I just tell them and I give them the 30-second version. And the thing is, and I think it is important because, you know, when you tell it to somebody and their eyes kind of glaze over and they go, hey, that's
then you know, pretty. You need to work on it.
Yeah. Cause the thing is, even
or
if somebody,
stupid.
Yeah, no, I don't think it's because they're stupid. I think it's because it just didn't connect with them. And
I showed somebody Eddie Izzard once and they asked me to turn on the closed captioning and I went, I can't be friends with you.
That's also taste. Taste is a really tricky thing. So if you
couldn't understand a British accent,
well, then that's their problem. That is their problem.
I think we can classify that as
stupidity. Okay.
But yes, no, I see your point.
Do you feel the energy here, which is you going, come on, people are stupid. And I'm like, no,
I'm
going
to drag you over to the dark side, Bob. I definitely agree. But I do think I like to believe the best in people. And people always laugh who met me recently because I was an optimist when I moved to LA. Now I'm a little cynical. But I, with friends, well, to this day, yesterday, I went to a coffee shop with a friend who's a writer and soundboarded some ideas of my current pilot script off of him. And he's like, what else are you working on? And I told him a couple other projects. And then I'd walk home. I had that brief thought of, yeah, I hope he doesn't steal any of them. You know, I don't think that he would.
Yeah.
And I'm glad I talked about them. And you need to talk about your projects. I agree with that. I would never do it with a stranger.
Yeah.
Talk about a project with a stranger. But aren't you ever worried when you do that? Is there any fear that somebody's going to take it and do it before you get to do it the way you want to?
No, because if it's an idea I'm really passionate about and something I'm really into, then I feel like I'm feeling that way because I'm the best person in the world to tell that story. And somebody else can try to do it better than me. And if they do it better than me, then I guess God bless them, whatever. But I feel like if it's coming from inside me, and then it belongs to me and nobody's ever going to do it better than me. And I mean, the thing that gets me is this is more the zeitgeist thing, which is like somebody I've never met is working on the exact same idea. And this has happened like the last three projects I've been writing. I'm like,
Armageddon, you know, Deep Impact.
I know, but it's like, it's crazy lately, especially like working in kind of that near future sci-fi space that I've been kind of enjoying a little bit lately. It's just like everybody's like, you know, I wrote my pilot that kind of got me my jump into TV, you know, was an idea that my manager at the time actually pitched to me. And I was doing some research on robots and he was like, hey, how about an idea about a jaded LA cop partnered with the first human robot. And I was like, okay. And I figured out, I'd been doing some research and I figured out the twist. I'm like, oh, that's me. I can write this better than anybody. And so then I write it and people loved it. And it got me my job on White Collar. I'm so excited about that. And then there were like four other scripts about that exact same thing. And Almost Human got made. And then it's like, you know, okay, now they can't make my show because somebody else. And I can't tell you how many meetings I took where people are like, man, I loved your script. I liked it better than Almost Human. You know, nothing against those guys because they're incredibly talented folks. But it's like when you hear that and you go, well,
But that's the weird thing about the universe, too. I mean, there was a play that I directed pieces of in college that I still think really time, it was written in the 40s, but it still is kind of relevant nowadays. Mm-hmm. And ever since I moved to LA, I've wanted to put it up. And no one had spoken about it in years. And I had just done a play with Michael Urie at the Hayworth. And I approached them and I said, hey, look, there's this play that I've been dying to direct forever. I would be interested if you would help me produce it. And they're like, well, yeah, let's read it. I'm like, even better. I'm going to do a stage reading for you. And I'm going to get all my friends. I brought like Victor Garber, Michael Urie, Chris Gorham, like all these great people together into their like black box theater to read this play. The day of, I'm like getting ready for the reading. And I see an announcement that Actors Gang had just optioned the script to put it up. And I was like, how the same day? What are the odds? And I feel like that's what the Armageddon Deep Impact, these movies that come out at the same time. I always wonder if there was one person who told someone and that's why, or if it really is this weird universal consciousness that everyone kind of just falls into the same place at the same time.
Yeah, I think it's the latter. And I think there's that.
I hope so.
But also there's that moment. You can look at it two ways. You can look at it as, oh, my timing was off. Crap. Or you can look at it as the universe is going, you're on track. Yeah. Your taste is in the right place. You're thinking about the right
things. Very Celestine Prophecy of you.
Don't give me that. Let's talk about other better books. Let's
I want to talk about Save the Cat, actually, because you had recommended it to me, but so did a bunch of other people. Right. Again, in the same year as I was writing, mm-hmm. people were like, you got to read Save the Cat.
Right.
I was like, here's three books. Save the Cat's number one.
Right.
I think everyone should read it. I also, though, I think a little differently than you, feel that everyone needs to learn the rules so they can break them correctly.
Absolutely.
I don't think you need to follow the rules perfectly, but I think mm-hmm. you need to be aware of them.
Right.
However, I had a hard time taking everything in that book as seriously because of his opinions mixed into it.
Yes.
Like calling Memento a bad movie. He almost lost me right there because I enjoyed it.
It's one of my top 10 films. So
it's amazing. But even more so, him using... He'd be like, well, in my wonderfully perfect script,
right.
blank check. And I'm like, that movie, really? That's what you're going to use as your resume?
And here's the thing. Blake, who wrote the book, passed away a few years ago. So, I don't want to...
No, I'm not trashing him.
I'm not going to trash him because he was a very sweet man. Here's the thing.
I'm almost like telling people this so they continue reading the book when they read these things.
Yes. Here's my thing. And this has been the way I've learned my entire life. Some people are like, there's... McKee, and they're like, this is McKee, and I do everything that McKee says. I've never been that kind of guy. I'm always like, I take bits and pieces from everybody that I learn from, and I take the stuff that matters to me. So even Save the Cat, there's some stuff in there that people don't like, some stuff that they do, but there's stuff in there that I think he doesn't get credit for that's really important, which is know what your movie's about. Know what's the primal core of your movie. That's the 30-second pitch of your movie, because all the time people will go, hey, I'm writing a movie. Can I pitch it to you? I'm like, yeah. Go ahead. And they go, okay, so there's this guy, and let me start over. 100 years ago, and I'm like, and you don't know what your movie's about.
No.
And he was very much about just get to it. Just get to the core of it. Get to why it's going to matter. And when I was writing Five Killers, which became Killers, a script that changed my life, people would ask me what I was working on, and I had kind of the 45-second pitch that I would pitch to people. And every single time I pitched it, they would go, yeah. They'd just get it, and they'd add a piece to the puzzle. Like, oh, it could be this person. It could be, and they'd start playing the game, and I'd realize that I was able to kind of get something in their guts and make them care about my story very quickly. And I think he doesn't get credit because he has a couple of chapters that really does. So it's like, to me, the other stuff, it's like the stuff about, his personal opinions and what he thinks a good movie versus what he thinks a bad movie. That's the kind of stuff I can let go of. But I feel he did a real service and is kind of underappreciated for just helping us know our stories better.
You know what's interesting? I had read Celestine Prophecy and had a hard time getting through it pre-college.
I had to read it for an acting class. You'll love that.
So did I.
Oh my gosh.
Freshman year, our professor who took over the class from the usual professor, who was an Orlando actress.
Yeah.
That was our textbook. She brought in Celestine Prophecy.
Right.
That was our textbook. And we had to reread it. And I very much feel, this isn't an ad for Celestine Prophecy or telling people to read it, I feel like the ideas it presents are great and interesting and worth reading.
Right.
The story of it is terrible.
Well, yeah.
And I tried, and I went and I bought the book that just kind of condenses the insights, and I realized that no one can read this and understand them. You need a framework to understand them.
Right.
But it's unfortunate the framework is so bad.
Yeah.
You have to force yourself to finish the book.
Right.
Very much, not comparing the two like that, but the idea of Save the Cat, where it's like, once you get past the opinions, there's a lot of great stuff in there, and some of the opinions, you agree with. I just had a hard time at the first time I read Save the Cat, taking that, I'm like, you just trashed a movie that I liked and are using a movie that I didn't to back up the point. It was hard to get through that. Mm-hmm. But you're right. The rules of it and the world that it sets up, totally. I do find it interesting what you just said, though. The number of people who come up to me to this day who are like, I have this idea for this short or this feature, and they tell it to me. And they're like, oh, it's this cool action thing where this stuff happens and this stuff happens. I'm like, yeah, but why are you making it?
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, because this stuff happens. And I'm like, no. Why are you making this movie? Mm-hmm. And it's amazing how many people don't have an answer. Yeah. The people who do tend to be the ones who work for a long time. Like, oh, because it's about how humanity can't do this. And like, oh, okay, you have a vision. You have a core thing to it. But a majority of people just thought a sequence would be cool.
Yeah.
And I'm amazed. I don't know where that started.
Well, I think the movie business has this allure where people look at it and go, oh, it's cool. making movies is cool. Being with movie stars, doing stunts, seeing cool action scenes. Cool. So
Abed, it's Abed from Community.
but it's like you I think you get drawn into that.
Yeah.
And that energy of like admiring it is different from the energy of like, I have stuff to say. I have stories inside myself, you know, about the human experience, and I need to share them. And if 10 people watch them, fine. If a million people watch them, fine. It's still at the end of the day, are you an innate storyteller? And mm-hmm. I feel like so many people get into this business and they're not true storytellers. They haven't figured out who they are as a storyteller yet. And you can actually get kind of far in this business without really having, you know, kind of your artist's soul figured out. Mm-hmm. And you know the difference though, especially if somebody's like, hey, check me out what I'm doing. You know whether or not that they've got the right stuff that's going to
yeah
you know,
the product or make their, a career. Or the attention. It's yeah. a very different thing.
Absolutely.
Let me ask you this. Where you're at right now,
yeah.
do you think, what is the likelihood that you're going to write a script that is your script and you will stay on with that script from beginning to end versus some other people coming in? Are you at the point now where you have to worry about other people taking the stuff over?
Oh, no, you never get out. You're never out of that business. It's just the way the movie business is. I feel like the way to protect yourself in that situation is to either direct the movie yourself or to partner with the director. Hmm. And so like my first film, The Air I Breathe, I co-wrote it with the director, and it was a passion project for both of us. It took us 6 years to write it and finance it and get it made and released. But that film, you know, it's not exactly what we were shooting for, but it was fairly close. And there's more of me in that movie on the screen than is, I think, ultimately in Killers. But Air I Breathe was protected because I wrote it with the director. And Jiho has he's an amazing director with a great vision. And I feel like the movie business is more geared to protect the vision of the director.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how you...
Why?
What's that?
Why?
Well, I mean, because they're the person at the end of the day that has to run the ship. They man the ship. At the end of the day, they are the ones. And that's like, you look at TV, and TV is a different culture because at the end of the day, it's the showrunner.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you want to be a writer who's seeing your work the way you want to see it produced, you've either got to be a director or partner with a director in the feature side. And the TV side, you have to run your own show.
Yeah.
And they're both incredibly difficult positions to attain.
And completely different.
Completely different, but they're also, there's no surprises. That's the way it is. You know, so we see that's, you know, so writers that come in and go, I've written the script and it's perfect, and go make it exactly word for word. I'm like, well, then you haven't done your research because you don't understand anything about this business.
Yeah.
But they'll learn. They learn the hard way.
More general question. What is the best writing tip? Give me a couple of the best writing tips you've ever gotten.
Never rewrite until you finish your first draft.
Oh, that's so important. It's so hard to do.
You've got to do it. You've got to finish your first draft.
I was just talking to somebody recently. Like, it's so easy to finish the scene and then have an idea for it and try to go back. And you just got to push forward through the whole thing.
You have to push forward because you can't rewrite. And it's like imagine doing a painting and you're just going to kind of, you finished a corner of it and you keep moving. And you just, wait, I'm going to go back to that corner. Mm-hmm. Now because you can't see it all. You can't really see the whole story until you've written the whole thing, even a bad version of it. Like I have a sense of what the themes of my movies are when I'm writing them, but I don't really know what a movie's about till I finish the first draft. And then I go, this is obviously the thing inside myself that I was trying to speak of here, but I don't know that until I've actually at least finished a draft.
You ever scare yourself?
What's that?
You ever like look back and be like, oh, I guess that's what I'm going on right now. Like, wow.
No,
exactly. I've written like a script where I was like, this is going to be a fun romantic comedy. I'm like, this is dark. What am I going through right now?
But then then that helps you because it's still kind of
frightening.
Yeah.
I was like, I'm going to write a romantic comedy about this one thing. And like within the first four pages, I'm like, this guy is hurt. Like, I guess I wrote that breakup went worse than I thought it did.
That's funny.
What's another tip? What's another tip that you've gotten that you hold on to?
Jeez. I mean, I'm a believer in making the page look amazing and making it an easy read. Mm. Like, I feel like people are so kind of caught up in their story that they want to tell and their vision that they kind of expect the reader to kind of do the heavy lifting and like trot, you know, just dig through their massive amounts of exposition and stuff like that. And the end of the day, our job is to entertain.
Yeah.
And even entertain on the page. So you know, some of the best compliments I've gotten are like, this is such an easy script. I tore through it in an hour. Oh my gosh. Like, I want them to love the movie. I want them to be excited about it, but I also want them to just be able to turn pages.
Yeah.
And so I'm always, and I think that's something that I'm always working on. Like, I have a style of my writing, but like, I go back and I read the original draft of Five Killers. I'm like, man, I was better back then. Like, I was, the pages turned quicker back then. So sometimes, I'll get, you know, a different habit or a different thing that I'm trying on the page. But it's also, to me, a work in progress. My style on the page is always evolving.
Oh, of course.
But the goal is always to make it a good read that somebody can sit down, because especially the people that read scripts for a living, executives, all you want to do is be the best 2 hours of their weekend. And it's hard, but if you can do that, that's when they want to call you and say, let's figure something out to do together.
Can I tell you, as an actor producer?
Yeah.
If somebody sends me, it's not often that I get offered stuff, but if people are like, for interest, they'll send you something for interest, which is the worst, because you're like, I'm interested. They don't want you. I'm like, damn it. but the number of times that I get a script and if by page five, I've just seen nothing but grammar errors, I've lost all confidence in your movie.
Yeah.
I no longer think you can make a good movie. And I know that's a very OCD analytical thing of me, but I'm like, if you can't figure out how to phrase the English language, then I do not believe you're going to be able to cut a movie together.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, I have a reading group, Pilot Palooza, at my my place every pilot season, where we just read a bunch of pilots, a bunch of actors, writers, and directors, reading them out loud.
Yeah.
So I kind of feel like I've given myself, I was about to say master's degree, but that's too egotistical, a bachelor's in screenwriting in that way. Because we read them out loud, and I tend to read a lot of the stage directions. It's amazing how many pilots, on page three, I see 20 people's eyes roll because they're like, oh my God, with the stage directions, enough. Like, this whole script is stage directions. Like, what do you think you're doing? Or, on the flip side, some people who are great writers, and all of the comedy is in the stage directions, and it's not in the script.
Yeah.
Like, they're really funny. Like, you can feel their sense of humor as they're typing it on their couch.
Right.
But none of the lines themselves are funny at all.
Yeah. And I've heard there's some tricks. Like, you put that in the stage direction, so when you're doing table reads for the network, you're
That's
getting
smart.
Laughs even during the what should be the dry part.
Or the network executive home on the weekend has had a long weekend. You know, you're reading, you're like, ha, ha, ha.
Yeah.
But then if that doesn't translate into the plot or the characters themselves being funny, then you just kind of show that you're funny, but you're not good at making it. Funny.
Yeah, that's a funny skill set. I don't know if that's a writer who's needing a writing partner. Like,
Maybe. Because I've written my whole life.
Right.
So much so that my mother still yells at me. She's like, why aren't you writing scripts? I'm like, it's a whole different career, Mom. I love you. You're listening right now, Mom. I do love you.
Yeah.
But it's this, it's not a lateral move.
Right.
It's a completely new career.
Yes.
But where was I going with this? But it's a very ethereal thing because it's not just take this one screenwriting class. You know how to write a script. It's a very delicate balance between whether it be comedy or drama, like putting your personality into the stage directions and the writing itself to an extent, not too much, but then also making sure every character is a voice that isn't just yours.
Yeah.
They need to be other voices. Some scripts, especially pilots that sell, which blow my mind.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, this was all the same person.
Yeah. Yeah. It's creating your voice as a writer is definitely a step in the journey, and it takes a while to figure out like who you are on the page, who you are thematically, who you are as far as the type of dialogue and action that you write. And finding that is a big part of the journey. I think once you get it and people read your stuff and go, okay, I know what I'm going to get from a script you've read, then it's just a matter of like, how good are your ideas? How good is the execution? How good is your timing on writing something that we need in this moment? Mm. But getting to that point as a professional where you've got a voice that people can rely on is a huge part of the journey and really, really hard.
Let me ask you this. If you're a network exec and I ask you, tell me what Bob DeRosa's voice is, what would be said?
I mean, I write character-driven action that's funny but not an outright comedy, romantic but not a big love story, and has a poignant heart.
Hmm.
And I mean, that's kind of the box that I work in. You know, I definitely like bantery dialogue, I've been told, and that feels right. You know, to me, it's like my voice is very fun and engaging and fast and cool, but it gets you. It's got heart at the end. And that's, you know, that's, and because I write in theater, it allows me to practice that and work on that in different mediums, and now working in a web series. And I think if you have a voice, it carries to whatever medium you're playing in at the time.
Let me ask you this, because if I had to boil it down, I've met two different kinds of writers. I have the kind of writer who legitimately casts the movie in their head mm-hmm. beforehand and just like writes, whether it be existing prototypes or friends, has those people talking. And then I have others who just create them on the page entirely. Right. Do you cast when you write of people you know or work you know?
I've done both.
Which do you prefer?
I think it's less about preferring and more just about kind of where I'm at in my process. Lately, I'm creating characters more from scratch.
Really?
Yeah. And I still see the actors that could play them because I want to make sure that whatever I'm writing is castable. But I think it's – I was way more – maybe earlier in my career, I was way – because I came from the film festival world, so like – I was really into a lot of indie actors. And so like I was, you know, like Mark Ruffalo, nobody knew who he was when I was mm-hmm. watching him at Sundance and stuff. So I was writing for actors that nobody even knew about, but that I knew were like amazing. And so I did that a lot more early on in my career. And now I think it's because like, you know, Air I Breathe, we cast that movie twice. Like we had a whole different cast and then people would fall out for whatever reason. And and so you start to see somebody in that role and then you have to like, oh, you have to let it go. And so at the end of the day, you need the character to live and breathe on its own because it could be this person and then that person could all of a sudden book Spider-Man 8 and then they're gone and then boom, you've got somebody else and you realize, you know what? At the end of the day, whoever says those words last owns those roles.
Well, yeah, definitely. I mean, when I went in for Transformers 2 to audition,
yeah,
I went in for a character that was named Jonah.
Uh-huh.
That was described as a Jonah Hill type and spoke like Jonah Hill.
Right.
And I auditioned and then they're like, yeah, they're offering it to Jonah Hill. I'm like, well, yeah. I mean, yeah, I could do my best, but if you literally were just like, only Jonah can play this, then fine. I can give you my impression of this man, Jonah.
Right.
You know,
right.
But it's a very different thing. But I do think that if you write it in a voice, it doesn't mean they can only, I mean, that's a bad actor. If only that actor can play that voice, there's other people who can do that voice.
Yeah, I wrote a script. It was like an ensemble action movie, and I had the quippy British, you know, bat, you know, kind of nerdy badass named Simon. And then I read like five scripts with the exact same character. I was like, what are those jerks doing? Everybody wants Simon Pegg to be in their action.
Nice.
So I was like, well, never mind. That wasn't as original as I thought it was.
Yeah, that's a whole separate thing. Yeah. Which movie that you've written or character that you've written is most you, your voice?
You mean me as a person?
Mm-hmm. You as a robot.
No. Oh, this is an awkward pause of dead air.
That's okay. It's a podcast. Most people are working out, driving. Yeah, they don't mind. They're checking to see if the podcast cut out, but it didn't. We're still here.
Weird. None of them are truly me. They're all little tiny facets of me.
Which is the closest, you think?
Oh my gosh. Like, I think I wrote a, let me think for a sec. I wrote a short film that was autobiographical called God Laughed. That was like a very important film for me because that was when I really kind of started to figure out my voice as a writer. That was a 30-minute short back in the day, but that was literally my voice. It was literally my life experiences. So I kind of got that out of my system. Mm-hmm. So then, and I got in a lot of trouble with my friends that are like, why am I in your movie? I'm like, ooh. So I got really good at like hiding myself.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I find it because so many people... As an actor, there's two different kinds of writers.
Mm-hmm.
There's the ones who are writing projects for themselves.
Right.
And then there's the ones who just like to write. Yeah. I very much am in the latter. I can't write for myself. And right. I should. I mean, it would really help my acting career if I could write for myself. And no script I've ever written has had a character that I could play. They're never right age or type wise. Like right. I do not like writing for myself.
So you don't like writing for yourself as a type, like as an age and like...
I don't ever want... When I find that... Me, not other people, but when I try to write something for me to be in, mm-hmm. it feels masturbatory and I feel like I'm trying to prove something and it's just not an interesting story to me.
Right.
Whereas, I mean, this pilot I'm writing right now, I just made this decision yesterday, actually, mm-hmm. after we chatted. I decided to make this younger character more like me than anything I've ever written. But for the most part, when I have an idea, it's not even an intentional thing. When mm-hmm. I have an idea... I finish it and I look back, I'm like, oh man, this person's like a 50-year-old woman. This person's like a 16-year-old kid. Like, I didn't even try to put myself into it, you know? Like literally me, not my voice, but literally me.
Yeah. See, I don't think I have any characters that are literally me in any of my scripts because I just don't. And it's like, I don't know. It's funny that you mentioned it because I've never actually thought about that ever, but they're all parts of me. You know, there's always, you know, there's my voice there, but it's also different sides of my voice. You know how, you know, there's also, I think, a lot of characters, especially characters that are at odds with each other. Mm-hmm. Those are the sides of yourself fighting. I think I just read somebody, I think it was maybe from one of those TV writing podcasts, where they're like, every character should be like a different point of view that you have kind of mm-hmm. fighting, you know, so like each character should either be your strength or your weaknesses, and they can fight it out, you know, and
that's really fascinating.
It's a little literal, and I'd rather create a character from scratch about something that interests me on a journey that interests me, and then get to the end of it and go, oh, wait, this is about, okay, wait. I did write a script called, and I wrote it last year, and it's called The Freelancer. Okay. And it's about, it's about a spy who's, you know, he's getting to that point. He's been a professional. He's fine. But he's, you know, he's a little bit like, am I going to keep doing this in my life? What's the next stage of my life? And he ends up having to hide out in this little North Carolina town. And he ends up kind of falling in love with a single mom and loves her kid. And then his, you know, enemies find him at the end of the movie. And he has to decide, you know, am I going to defend this life, or am I going to go back to my old life and be a spy and go kick mm-hmm. ass? And I love that script. And that was because it was also very much about, you know, I've been in this career for over 10 years. You know, am I going to keep doing this for another 10 years or 20 years? Or am I going to find a different medium? Am I going to, you know, I'm kind of, you know, I can always be at that point where I think about that. So I think that character, I mean, he's definitely, you know, more of a badass than I am, but he really was, I think, thinking about the kinds of things that I think about and mm-hmm. dealing with the kinds of life issues that I think about. So that character, I think, was really me on the page in a certain way. And there's a lot of parallels that really excited me about that script. And I loved it passionately. We sold it out and everybody passed.
Nice.
Nobody
yeah.
wants
of
to
course.
Make that movie at all. And I'm like, really? So there's like,
well, that's like my first pitch ever to a network exec. Yeah. There was the passionate project I loved that I had my first pitch ever. I explained for probably 20 minutes, beat by beat, and their eyes just glazed over, and they went, what else do you got?
Yep.
And I said the two-sentence project that my friend was working on with me, and he was like, oh, I love that one. I'm like, of course. Yep. The one that I put all my heart and soul into, no one gives a crap about, of course.
Yeah.
The way this is going to sound really Sybil of me to say, but the way that I always look at it is when I'm writing, there's a hotel in my head and mm-hmm. all these people living in it, and I'm writing in their voices. So it doesn't really feel like me. It feels like it is me because it's my freaking head.
Right.
But it doesn't feel like me. It feels like these other people. However, funny enough, this pilot that I'm writing, there's this older character and this younger character. And I realized, I was like, okay, before I even wrote a word, I was like, this older character is the cynical part of me, mm-hmm. the part of me who's, you know, like burnt and whatever.
Right.
And then the younger one is the optimistic part of me. And it's the first time literally pre-writing, I sat down and went, these two characters are two facets of my thought process and my voice. So it's really interesting for you to say that because it was yesterday that I stumbled upon deciding to make these characters this way.
Right.
I'm kind of curious. Time travel, I want to go to the future and see what the script ends up being because of that. Interesting. Another random tangent? Sure.
Yeah.
Speaking, really a good quality to have for a podcast. Have you ever had a script idea or been midway through a script and realized that it, you know, people tend to boil down their taglines. It's like this meets this.
Yeah.
Or it's kind of like that, but it's different. And it's hard to not do that. What is that? Aristotle said there's only seven stories or something.
Yes.
Sorry, theater educators. Mm-hmm. I just completely bumbled that. Have you ever been writing a script and then realized, oh, this is kind of like this other project? That's been like, this is kind of like this other movie.
Yeah.
It's your own voice and it's your own take, but has it ever turned you off on writing something?
Yes. Which I don't like that's happened. Yeah. There's been, I had this really cool idea for like a sci-fi action movie, and I've been kind of wrestling with it for a year, trying to figure out a way in. And it was one of those, my manager just sent me another project that had been, you know, picked up and was probably going to get made, and it had a lot of the same elements. And there was that feeling of like, oh no, well, this is too close. And so I abandoned it pretty early on. The script I'm working on right now there's like multiple movies out, which are playing in the same, like they all have the same setup and then go off in totally different directions, mm-hmm. you know? So that's, you know, it's a little infuriating.
Does it still make you stop wanting to work on them?
It does. And this gets back to, I mean, you know, career choices and life choices, which is like, I think you write certain movies because you have no choice, because your soul is going, there's something important here. Mm-hmm. Get into it. So like, I knew my little spy hiding out of a small town was not going to, you know, sell for $1 million. I'm like, that's, you know, I'll be lucky if it gets made. but I still wanted to write it. And so I never look back and go, oh, I wish I hadn't written that because it didn't sell last year, because that movie's going to get made. Somebody, you know, I'm going to find the right champion for that movie. I feel if you write a movie and you write it because you think it's a cool idea and it could be a great movie and it doesn't sell and you're just like, I wish I hadn't written that. Then it's like, well, those are the movies that sometimes if I'm in the middle of and I go, oh, there's another movie just like it, I can put it, if I can put it away and not be haunted by it, then it's probably the best thing to put it away.
Hmm.
But I think that's, especially as being a professional writer, I think there's your work, there's your labors of love and the movies that you write because you think they're cool and you hope that they're going to get made and sell and make you a living. And I think always the goal is for those two things to be the same thing.
Yeah.
But it's really hard. And
on all parts of the industry, you know, yeah. Studio movie, independent movie,
absolutely.
Studio movie, independent
absolutely.
Movie.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the goal. Yeah. Getting to that position where you can do that is actually an impressive
feat. It's hard. Like Air I Breathe was that way for me. Like that was a labor of love and I ended up making money off of it. I was able to survive for a period of time out and I was really proud of the finished product. And like, that was one of those moments where it all came together for me. And I think that's, once you have a taste of it, that's what you're always going for in your career.
You wrote a blog post about balancing multiple projects,
yeah.
which I find interesting, but curious, how many projects are you willing to balance at the same time before you feel overextended?
I mean,
keeping in mind, one, you're actively writing a draft on, the other one, you're still probably workshopping in your head or whatever.
Yeah. When I'm actually working on a draft of something, I prefer to only be writing that draft.
Okay. So when are you balancing then?
When I'm balancing are the small side projects. So like right now I'm writing a feature script. So I'm also, let's see what I'm doing. I'm, you know, preparing to release and shoot a couple more episodes of our web series. Mm-hmm. But the thing is like, those are like 2-page scripts. So mm-hmm. when it came time during this process to write one of those scripts, I would just take a half a day and go, I'm going to write my 2 pages. That's done. Okay. I can go back to my script now. So that's, I can balance that. Writing my theater piece, you know, I was, you know, every, you know, the way this show works, you get voted back. Oh my God, I got another, you know, 8-page episode next week. So I would take Sundays and go, that's my theater writing day. In my mind, I'm like, I have a pilot that's in negotiations right now. So in my mind, it's like, well, I need to have my next TV thing kind of chambered up. So I have a network pitch I'm putting together. And then I also have, you know, kind of an outline for like a cable spec show that, you know, I might just write for the hell of it because it's something that I think is cool and it could end up being a sample or something. And what ends up happening is like I'll turn in a draft of the thing I'm working on, the major thing that's the most amount of my time. I'll turn that into my manager. And it might take me a couple of days to get notes. So I'll spend one day goofing off on the internet and wasting time, and then I'll feel really bad. And I'm like, okay, well, the notes didn't come yesterday. I can't waste another day. So then I'll take today, and I'll work on my outline for my cable thing. So it's always about having something to work on when all of a sudden there's a built-in gap in your process.
2 questions.
Yeah.
One. As a writer, you're always working in a way, you know, yeah. like you've, yeah. I think you even said in your blog, like yeah. you're waiting for a movie to start and you're still running through some possible plot things in your
absolutely,
head, but
yeah.
sitting in front of your computer, staring at final draft, how many hours a day do you think you are working?
I mean, I'm in my office 7-8 hours a day. I'm not staring at final draft the whole time.
Yeah.
If I'm writing, you know, balls to the wall, cranking out pages. Honestly, you can write 3 or 4 hours and I can be wiped out at the end of that. And like,
it's
that's
tiring enough. In a weird way.
Yeah. It's like, I spend almost
feels
much
like
time.
It shouldn't be, but it is.
It's exhausting, especially because that's when you know you're in the right spot is when you get that kind of exhausted. I can't believe
it's crazy. It's kind of, I mean this in the nicest way possible. It's how I've always described conventions to people doing conventions.
Yeah.
Cause it's like, you're just hanging out with people for like 12 hours, but it's so much more exhausting than going to the gym for 5 or shooting something shooting is tiring, but shooting for 20 hours is less exhausting yeah. than doing a convention for 10. And yesterday I pitched a couple of projects mm-hmm. and then really, really focused on workshopping the pilot that I'm writing right now. And I was drained within 3 hours.
Yeah.
I was just like, I need to lay down.
Yeah. It goes back to like my martial arts training is like, we talk about, you know, spirit. You know, because you know, you have your physical training, your mental training, and your spiritual training. And the way we define spiritual training is attention. You're putting your attention on your opponent when you're fighting. So the thing is, you put your spiritual attention on everything in your life. And you're either, you know, kind of overwhelming the situation and owning the situation, or the situation's owning you. So when you go to, you know, when I'm writing or you go to a convention or you're on set working, you're putting your attention towards something. So mm-hmm. even at a, you know, going, you know, the party that's after your appearance at the convention, you're still kind of on and you're still meeting people and you're still either you're being cool to fans or you're saying hi to people that you know in the industry. You're still putting your attention there, and it's work. And you're right. It takes it.
It's a hard thing to talk about to people who aren't in the industry because they're like, you know, sounds like one of those hashtag first world problems kind of thing. Yeah. But it's true. It's totally it's a hard thing to explain, except for people who understand that. Yeah. Interesting. My other question for you is, are you? You're very obviously at the position in your career where you're established enough where you could pitch something that isn't written.
Yes.
Yet.
Yes.
When was that first moment? When did you know, or when were you allowed to pitch an unwritten script?
I mean, very early on, my first job in Hollywood was a pitched script, and it was,
With an outline?
No. What happened, and there was, the situations are always different. But like I'd written this sample script that everybody in Hollywood read and almost sold multiple places and it didn't quite sell. But it got me a lot of meetings. And so one of those meetings was an executive who'd read some of my indie stuff and really liked my stuff. It's Naveen McElharji, who used to work at Revolution Studios, and he's got his own company now and doing awesome. But he was working for Todd Garner, who's now a huge producer. And Todd was the president of production at Revolution Studios. And they had an idea for a movie that they wanted to do. And they just, the writer had fallen off of it and they're like, we need somebody to come in with a fresh take. So I was a brand new writer, but I had kind of the right sample and I had that right kind of energy and I went in and I pitched my version of the movie and they hired me to write it.
When was the first time you were able, or how early in your career were you able to, without an idea that they wanted to hear your take on, that you came up with an idea from scratch and tried to sell it without a full script written?
I mean, Killers definitely helped. So like getting something made is kind of the linchpin moment when they kind of want to hear your next thing.
Okay.
So yeah, actually I went out with a pitch after Killers, that I was actually, something I worked on with Topher Grace actually, who's super cool. And he had a project that I worked on and that didn't sell. And so then I had another project that I pitched him and we went out with something and that we actually went out during the worst pitching season that has ever been known. Like right after the writer strike and the economic crash, we went out pitching movies and they're like, you guys are so cute. But the thing is as far as getting into rooms, having that project that's either on its way or in my case, having the movie get made was the thing that said, okay, well, we want to hear your thing. You know, getting in the rooms and actually selling those things are sometimes very different things.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I'm going to make you condense quick answers for these two next questions.
Okay. Are you saying I'm rambling?
No, we're short on time now.
I feel you.
And I want to answer these.
Okay.
And because I know it's gonna piss you off. So quickly.
Yes.
Tell me, what is your writing process?
Quickly.
and that screwed up that I just did that?
Yeah.
Quickly. Even if we weren't short on time, I was going to make you do
and,
that.
And actually, I have a 7-page document that I wrote up that I gave to my writers group because we all decided we should share our processes. So I wrote this up. I'm actually going to put it on my blog, BobDeRosaWriter.com. I've been threatening to do
Everyone
that.
Everyone should read.
Yeah.
Even though you're like me, you know, you're bad at updating all the time.
But I'll take this document and I'll put it on there so you can actually read like the 7 pages
Please
of what
do.
I do.
By the way, briefly. Random side note, I love that you said, I'm noticing in my life that trying to do something in this industry and having people say nope, that really fires me up to figure out how I can turn a no into a yes. This is why we're friends. Exactly the same.
Yeah.
If anyone ever says you can't do something to me, exactly when I have to do it.
Judge me crazy.
Love it. But so it's going to come out and it's probably going to be way more in depth and whatever,
the quick
but I want a
the
quick, the quickest you can give me. All what right. is your writing process?
Start with an idea, start with a log line, something that I can tell people and they light up and go, oh my God, that's going to be a great idea. And then I try to, as much as I can, build it out in steps, beat sheet, treatment, get notes on the treatment, show it to my writer's group, show it to my manager, get people to give me their feedback at every stage of the process, as small a stage of the process. So when I'm writing a 3-page beat sheet, it should still work. They should still be able to see the movie. So I'm doing step by step by step until finally I feel like I've figured out the movie. Then I write the script beginning to end. I don't stop. I write it in order. I never jump ahead and write other scenes. And then I work on that draft a lot, rewriting on my own. Then I start to get feedback. And then I do steps, you know, several drafts, you know, going back and forth with my manager and my friends getting feedback before I finally say, okay, I have a script. That's the first draft that the town will see. That's considered the first draft. But for me, there's many steps and many stages for people to kind of come in and read it and go, I'm not quite understanding something here. And so, and the thing is like, that's, I know how to do that, and I try to do it as good as I can. Sometimes I just get super excited and I want to skip a step, and sometimes it works out great, and sometimes I'm in hell. Just depends on the project.
It's kind of like you start a little nugget and you kind of expand it.
Absolutely.
Other quick questions. So you and I both love to do this. We have gone at the same time multiple times. Why do you love Sundance, and why do you think people should go? They don't have a movie there.
Yeah. It's funny. You meet a lot of people and you talk about Sundance. So they're like, I'm not going to go until I have a movie there. And I'm like, I love going someplace other than where you live for the sole reason of like just absorbing art. And, you know, I never go to museums in town, but whenever I go to another country, I go to all the museums I can. And I feel like Sundance is a place where you can go. If you love films, you go there, and you are, for a period of time, you're in a town where everybody loves movies. Everybody's excited to see movies. Everybody's talking about movies. And it's not in the LA way where it's everyone. There is the LA version of it where everybody's talking about the business of it. But there's, I mean, the first time I went, I'm just meeting a doctor and his wife from Midwest who just fly there every year because they want to see movies. And it's inspiring. It's so inspiring and so much fun. And I highly recommend it. I think, you know, if you love film, if you love film as art or just film for enjoyment, you should go all the time.
I love Sundance. Another quick one, and then we'll get to rapid fire questions. What's your dream project that you're not making?
My script, The Freelancer, is a dream project that I'm not making, that I will make. I'll find a way. And I'm really fascinated and excited by television, and I've had experience now doing working in TV, but also doing serialized storytelling in my theater world. Mm-hmm. And to be able to write, you know, to be able to create something that's truly me and really cool and is a long story with multiple chapters and multiple evolutions of that storyline would be really exciting. So selling my own show is absolutely my next goal and something I'm working very hard at right now.
Do you want to be a showrunner someday?
You know, I think I do. Which is probably not the right answer, because I think showrunners, you have to be all in 100%. I hope that I am built for the lifestyle, which is just 90-hour weeks, which I generally don't work 90-hour weeks. So I hope that the job doesn't wear me down to the point where I hate it. I think that I have the creative depth and creative passion to want to create something and to just jump in and tackle it and be surrounded by really smart people and build something. So I like to believe that I have a show in me. You know, creating a show that then have other people to help me run, 100%, I'm ready for that right now. So that's the thing.
Okay.
Probably happen first.
So as quickly as possible, as we go into these rapid fire questions, this one isn't rapid fire, but we still want it fast. J.J. Abrams is involved in the new Star Wars. I want you to pitch to him why you should do the next one and what it would be. Go.
That's an awful, awful question.
Go.
He's
an avid listener. So.
Yeah, I want to do the spinoff movie where I just want to do like the movie on Tatooine where like stormtroopers are just kind of kicking ass, and I just want to see the people. I want to see the siege movie. I want to see the Star Wars siege movie.
Ooh,
where like literally they're just holed up in their little, you know, Tatooine bubble. And it's a ragtag bunch to get stuck together. And there's just like a siege of stormtroopers and bad guys. And they have to protect, you know.
The Raid 3 Tatooine. That's amazing.
I want to see.
Pretty sure you sold it right now. J.J. Abrams is going to, someone's going to email it to him and be like, you need this guy.
I would like to write that movie.
Rapid fire as fast as possible with answering the question. What do you think of the ending of Lost?
Ending of Lost, I mostly loved it because of the emotional payoff. The stuff on the island, plugging up the hole with the thing. I didn't like the plugging up the hole thing, but ultimately I thought that they mostly succeeded and I was pleased with it.
What do you think of the ending of Battlestar Galactica?
I kind of loved it. I mean, I think the very last shot with Ron Moore acting, but most of that finale episode was pretty amazing.
What do you think of the ending of Fringe?
I liked it a lot. Actually, I liked that last, a lot of people kind of, I thought it could have ended with the season before, that they had a great ending, but the final season I still thought was really cool and emotionally compelling.
Name two shows that you try to watch as live as possible so no one spoils it for you.
Walking Dead and Game of Thrones.
That's everyone's answer, man. I'm going to have to eventually like,
they nailed it though. They nailed it. They created the, how do we keep people from watching it a week later? It's like, well, you kill somebody and you don't want to get it spoiled and you have to watch it. So those are the two.
Oh, this past week's episode. You know, I got to address this real fast. We're short on time, but I'm hijacking rapid fire. It's a compliment but also not. Especially after this past week's episode. The number of people who have seen pictures of me with fans at conventions and thought that I was Ramsay Bolton. Or people who are like, hey, Dave, has anyone... Yes, everyone has told me that they think that I look like him. I don't know that I consider it a compliment in general, just physically.
Yeah.
But after last week's episode, I'm going to declare a moratorium on it. Don't cool. tell me that I'm like him in any way, because
I was thinking about it today. There are villains that you love to hate, and then there are villains you just hate. And yeah. Ramsay is one of those characters. There's no love to hate him. It's just...
As an actor, I would have killed to play that role and how much fun and everything about it. But I think after last week, we can just say that...
Can we just...
Okay, let's all agree. Fine. We're similar. But yeah. I don't want to hear about it.
Let's just say less rape on television. Can we just say that? Not to hijack it, but just we've had enough.
Oof, I was about to make a joke, but I won't. Name one writer's career that you don't think they're doing a bad job in any way whatsoever, but you wish you could just step into and take over.
Oh, that's an amazing question.
I get one per podcast.
Yeah. One writer's career. Let me think. God, no, this is odd. It's just all these names are tearing through my head. It's a director. Rian Johnson comes to mind.
Cool.
Because he's amazing.
That's good.
And he's amazing, doing incredible work. And I suppose he's the nicest guy in the world. And like, you know, when he works, like people like Vince Gilligan sit around and go, how lucky are we to have this guy? And like just have somebody who seems to be so humble and connected and yet so gifted that everybody around him just feels there's something special. I would like to be doing work that inspires people as much as his work inspires people.
Do you want to direct?
What's that?
Do you want to direct?
Not really. I used to. I might someday. I might have to direct a freelancer just to make the damn thing.
Oh, yeah. This industry. Years from now, you're dead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And at the, let's say the Academy,
sure.
There is a wall with a giant picture of you.
Right.
And underneath, there's a plaque. And inscribed on that plaque is a quote. What is that quote?
Where he came from, nice guys finish first.
Oh, I like that. Well, that's a good one. Did you prepare that? You prepared that a lot, didn't you?
No, I have a secret.
But. Some people have listened to the podcast before they comment. Some people haven't. And I find that I love some of the answers that come under.
It was my Twitter tagline for like 1,000 years. So
finally, we're playing a game. We started a little bit ago when I was younger in Florida. We would call 1-800 in some sort of dirty phrase. And if it was a porn thing, you won. If it wasn't, the other person won. And then later it became a drinking game. So we've been having people say, give me a 7-ish letter phrase that is a dirty phrase. And we're going to call it real fast and see if it's porn or not. If it is, you win. If not, you don't.
Oh, right.
We did 1-800 wet toes was the one that we first
found. 1-800 eat butt.
EATBUTT. Okay. Here we go. Hold on. Let's see if it is. Oh, man. I got a good feeling about this one.
Oh, like it hot?
Yeah.
Oh, like it wet?
Okay.
We do like it hot. You've
come to the right place. Okay. Well, yeah, it's actually done. Well done, because you know the past 4 or 5 episodes, it actually hasn't been, and one we accidentally, I think, possibly called the FBI. So that was fantastic.
I totally won.
Well done, Bob. You win. You win the month of May.
All right.
And then I just want you to tell everybody 20 Seconds to Live. It's the next thing they need to look out for with Adam Green, Ben Rock,
Aerie, and our producer Kat Pasiak, who's amazing.
Okay, and that comes out June 5th.
It launches on Aeriescope.com, and it's going to run for 7 consecutive weeks.
Cool. And we'll put a link to your blog underneath this and your Twitter. Your Twitter's just your name?
At ThemBob.
ThemBob. Them being the original improv group that you were part of.
Mm-hmm.
And Sacred Fools, when is the next thing at Sacred Fools for you?
For me, no plans. I just, you know, the new season of Serial Killers will start up in the fall. Come check it out. It's a really fun time, and anybody can submit scripts. And they actually have a new late night show called The Box, which is going to be experimental and weird, and you should actually write for it. I'm going to tell you about it.
But
you can find out all this stuff on sacredfools.org. They have, and there's so many opportunities to just submit something and maybe get something up on stage, and then you have a chance to maybe become part of the theater family there.
Ooh, I like it, which is important nowadays, especially with all these. Equity controversy.
Absolutely.
But anyway, thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
And I'll probably kidnap you again for another podcast in the future.
That sounds great.
And thank you all for listening. Join us next week when we have a different person.